Case number 12-1042 et al. BNSF Railway Company Petitioner versus Surface Transportation Board et al. Mr. Rosenthal for petitioners BNSF Railway and Union Pacific Railroads. Mr. Rosenberg for petitioners Arizona Electric Power Cooperative. And Mr. Reed for respondents.
May it please the court, Michael Rosenthal for the railroad petitioners, and I've reserved 3 minutes. We're here because the board applied its rate test in a way that failed to account for a fundamental feature of the service to which the challenged rates applied, the interchange point established by BNSF and UP. And the board never addressed our statutory argument that it was required to account for the interchange points. This was the first time the board was asked to address the relevance of Section 10703 to its standalone cost methodology, and it didn't even cite the statute. Now, most...
What is it in the statute that helps in the definition of an SARR?
Section 10703, when two railroads are required to provide interline service, that's when one can't move the traffic from the origin to the destination by itself, Section 10703 requires them to establish through routes, including physical connections, which means that one railroad is required to hand off the traffic to the other at a designated location called an interchange point. What it does is it makes the location of the physical connection, the interchange point, a fundamental feature of the service these rails are providing. It establishes their division of responsibility for the transportation.
But as I understand it, the railroads, when they have a joint rate, are jointly and severally liable for anything, any liability standing alone. It's their feet that one railroad, right? As opposed to other kinds of the terminology here is very tricky. Other kinds of ways in which two or more railroads with separately challengeable segments of a route enable shippers to take things a multi-railroad distance.
Right, well, a few things, because the terminology is confusing. That's why I tried to take some time to define the terms I'm going to try to use. But the issue of joint and several liability is actually a separate concept, and it comes from a separate part of the statute.
What's provided in 10703 is a separate concept as well.
Well, exactly. The notion of joint and several liability talks about what happens if the railroads are found to have charged unreasonable rates. Section 10703 talks about what it means to charge an interline rate. What are the fundamental features of an interline rate? And it says that an interline rate is a rate that applies to a service with these defined interchange points. So the first question is, what is this rate we're challenging? What are the fundamental features? How do you apply this standalone cost test that the board has developed? And the notion that there are different types of interline rates, that there are joint interline rates, that there are some that are formed as a combination of rates, doesn't help the board. It sort of points out a flaw in their, well, there's not an analysis, but Section 10703 doesn't distinguish among the types of interline rates. It says that the interchange points is a fundamental feature of all interline rates. So there's really no reason to distinguish among when the interchange point matters and when it doesn't. And so in this case, the interchange point is fundamental. When APCO asked for rates, BNSF and UP provided prices for interline service using designated physical connections. The common carrier authorities that they, the tariffs that they gave to APCO, they're in the appendix, pages 15, 37, and 43, each specifies the interchange points. The railroads recognize that the interchange point is fundamental. They're part of the tariffs, and they have to be considered in this joint rate. But what happened here was that in designing its hypothetical railroad for its rate challenge, APCO ignored what were the established interchange points.
A couple of questions. If you're applying the 180% rule, that involves looking at the actual line over which the commodities moved.
Yes, Your Honor, that involves...
As opposed to the hypothetical one that defines the SARR.
Yes, that's right.
Clear. And, for SARR purposes, can you have an SARR where there's no rail at all? Let's assume just one railroad. If it goes from A to B via X, and the shipper devises a nicer route, cheaper route, which does not go by X, how does that work out?
The board said, the ICC said in its coal rate guidelines that this would be permissible. To my knowledge, that's never happened. I think that there's a real statutory question whether that is a proper interpretation of the statute. I think just like Congress expected the board to account for the interchanges, the railroad's division of responsibility, I think an argument could be made that Congress probably thought that the test would be conducted using an actual railroad. It seems like a pretty basic point. You're trying, the whole exercise here is to test the reasonableness of a rate for a service.
Yeah, but once you go away from the actual railroad that provides the actual tracks that provide the service, you're off in a different land.
Well, that's why I'm saying...
I think a simple one railroad case.
That's why I'm saying I think the pipeline case is also questionable as a matter of statute. That hasn't been challenged. It hasn't come up. It wasn't an issue here. But I don't think the fact that the board has said some crazy things about the SAC test means that everything else is...
They haven't implemented that particular hypothetically crazy thing.
Right. Well, the fact that it said some crazy things are possible doesn't mean that anything less crazy is okay under the statute. You know, again, the purpose here is to test the reasonableness of a railroad.
We have a new principle of statutory interpretation here.
the purpose is to test the reasonableness of a rail rate, and you can't do that without trying to figure out what the fundamental features of this rate are. And it's not a question of whether or not you apply the standalone cost test, the SAC test.
So
it's how you apply the SAC test.
I'm sorry. Is your argument that doing it this way is inherently unreasonable and arbitrary and capricious, or is your argument that doing this way violates specific statutory provision, or both?
It's both. I think the argument we focused on in our brief is that the statute says you have to take account of the interchange point, the actual service being provided in applying the SAC test.
The statute says that.
The statute says that.
And what language in the statute, I know you're covering ground you've covered, but what language in the statute specifically supports you, or I guess the better way to say it, which language in the statute specifically forbids the board from doing it this way?
Well, there are two things. It's first, in Section 10704, the board is supposed to have authority over rates charged or collected. And so you have to go and figure out what is this rate that they have authority over. And 10703...
Isn't that for the actual railroad?
No, that's to have authority to issue some sort of relief in a case.
Right. That's the rape that's being questioned.
That's the rape that's being questioned. And the question here is whether the board has ever actually evaluated the rape. And Section 10703 helps you understand or tells you that the rate includes the interchange point, and it requires railroads to establish rates that are applicable to those routes. So the rate is applicable to a route that's defined by the interchange point. And the statute, in the case of interline rates, says that the route is defined by this interchange point.
Well, it seems like the statute, you agree that the board can use the SAR test as a general matter.
Absolutely.
And so the question then becomes, it seems to me that there's a gap in the statute about how to analyze this kind of particular situation, and therefore really step two, kind of general reasonableness analysis of the board's approach. So why is that wrong?
It's not a gap in the analysis. The point is that this case, the standalone cost methodology applies in every case. It's how you apply it to the particular rate.
There's a gap as to how to deal with the interchange location issue. There's nothing specific about that, nor. But you would say 10703 is specific.
10703 says that when you have through routes, when you have to have this interchange, that the interchange point is a fundamental part of the rate. You're not testing the rate unless you're accounting for the interchange point in that analysis.
Am I wrong? I understood your argument to be that you offered this interpretation of the statute and the board didn't respond to it, correct?
Yes.
I mean, are you telling us that I understand your statutory theory and I want to ask the board about it when they're up here, but is it your theory that your interpretation of Section 10703 and 10704 is compelled by the statute, or is it that this is an ambiguity that the board itself needs to resolve that hasn't done that?
In a different setting, I would be arguing that it was compelled by the statute. I think it is. I think there's no other way to interpret what Congress was saying there when you look at the text, the purpose, the history. But you know, the first problem is that the board didn't address it at all. The board didn't cite Section 10703. We don't know what they thought of that theory. They haven't offered an interpretation of Section 10703 that this court can even evaluate whether it's reasonable, whether it's permissible, whether Congress said something else.
All right. Anything else?
Your argument is right. Why is it that when we look at 10703.1, talk about reasonable facilities for operating a through route, that's got to include not only the interconnection, but the whole railroad, right? So your argument has the odd characteristic, it seems to me, that if you look at the map on page 12 of your brief, which I found very helpful, it would be perfectly fine if the board did what it liked, assuming argument after these purposes, like the old railroad there, so long as it didn't monkey with the interchange point. But the reasonable facilities for operating the through route seem to encompass not only the interconnection point, but the whole railroad. It seems to me your argument, as a matter of logic, takes you much farther than you are willing to go.
The question is what's the rate? What is the rate? What's the service that's provided? And we say that in this case on page 12, you've got coal moving from New Mexico to an interchange, from BNSF in New Mexico to an interchange with Union Pacific in New Mexico, and then on to the plant. And we think that those are the fundamental features of the rate, using that interchange. It's not that the standalone railroad has to replicate the entire railroad structure. There's nothing in the statute, and the board points this out, I think it actually helps us. There's nothing that says you need to put a yard in a particular place or a communication tower in a particular place or use a particular type of locomotive or pay an engineer or anything. What the So, those are all things that the shipper can vary when it's using this standalone cause methodology. But what's fundamental and what the statute says is that the interchange point matters, the railroad's actual responsibility for providing the transportation. And that means you have to account for the interchange point.
Anything else?
Now, in this case,
I just don't see words in 10703 that elevate interchange point so dramatically.
Because it's the provision that requires railroads to establish interchange points when they're providing a through route. There's nothing comparable in the statute that says you have to care about intermediate points when you're establishing a single line railroad.
Okay. You done?
It's a point that only applies to through routes.
You done?
I see my time.
Yes. Okay, yep. Thank you.
Good morning, and may it please the Court. Robert Rosenberg on behalf of Petitioner Arizona Electric Power Cooperative, or APCO, and having reserved 1 minute for a rebuttal, if possible. APCO challenges two aspects of the decisions below. APCO first challenges how the Board costed BNSF's short-line outsourcing arrangement. BNSF subcontracts to reduce costs, and the arrangement has that effect. But the board treats the arrangement as increasing cost and by a substantial amount. Converting a cost savings arrangement into one that increases cost is inherently unreasonable. Where regulated rates are supposed to reflect cost, lower cost should not mean higher rates, and that's the situation we have here. The board claims it was just following what it did in a case that was just like this one. But the KCP&L case was not just like APCO. In KCP&L, the effect was de minimis, just pennies a ton. In APCO's case, the impact is substantial, $1 million a year or more. The board's reasoning is apparently that it can use an approach that does not make much sense and need not even consider if it makes any sense, because it used that approach just once without considering the impact in a case where it didn't make any difference. An approach that may work reasonably well in one case should not be applied in another case where it works poorly. To give an analogy, just because I pick up a knife once by its handle and it works fine doesn't mean that I'll get the same result when I pick it up by its blade. And yet that's the substance of the board's reasoning. Carriers outsource to make themselves better off, chiefly by reducing costs, even after the cost of the additional interchange are considered. If outsourcing increases costs, there is no reason to do it other than gaming. Yet the board's approach systematically makes short-line outsourcing appear more expensive. The fact that the increase was small in the KCP&L case is no reason to subject APCO to a substantial increase. In the board's brief, but not the decision itself, the board claims that APCO has made a prohibitive movement-specific adjustment. That is incorrect. APCO relies entirely on system average costs and ignores the BNS savings that a movement-specific approach would reflect. It is the board that makes a movement-specific adjustment by treating the short line as a third carrier. The short line is not a party to the tariff, is not a defendant in the litigation, has no stake in the outcome of the litigation, and is a stranger to APCO. Treating the subcontractor as a third carrier just constitutes a movement-specific adjustment that distorts the cost analysis. APCO also challenges the second decision that upheld the carrier's switch from the joint through rates that APCO successfully challenged to the separate proportional rates. The board claims that the rates are the same and that APCO has no injury and no standing. The problem is that APCO is exposed to higher charges when a train is too short or too light. With joint through rates, the trains are measured once. With proportional rates...
How do we know that's going to happen? Are you sure that's going to happen? I thought that was debated as to whether that would really happen.
Well, in the addendum on standing to our reply brief, we provide an example mm-hmm. where the carriers charged for different weights for the same train. Mm-hmm. So it has happened once. It's not purely speculative, and it has the potential to repeat itself. Cars do get bad ordered in transit. Railroads have detectors to see if there are hot wheels and if a car needs to be set out. Mm-hmm. So it's happened once. It can happen again.
Is there a mechanism for challenging that in light of the board setting a 10-year period for which its ruling and basic case prevails?
The board argues that there is. Our position is that the carriers change the rates. We are made worse off. It does not comply with the prescription because there can be higher charges. There have been higher charges. We filed a petition at the board. The board denied it. We would like to have had the issue resolved, and the board said that the calculations are the same. They aren't the same. There's one case where they haven't been the same.
Yeah, but maybe you have a case in terms of the board's denial of a remedy, or will have a case, denial of a remedy with respect to a particular case where railroads charge different numbers of cars on the train. But why can't that be processed by the board and then appealed if you lose?
That would be litigious, expensive, inefficient.
You mean it's probably pretty small in relation to legal costs, right?
That's part of what I mean, and it's also the case
that sure that we should reach out and grab a case.
Again, our position is that we successfully brought a case challenging one sort of rate, and we won, and then the carriers go and change the rate, and the board says that's okay when it leaves us worse off.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. Andrew Reed on behalf of the Surface Transportation Board and the United States government. The railroads concede that the hypothetical railroad used in a SAC analysis need not replicate the operations of the real world railroad, except in the context of a joint rate where it has to route the traffic of the hypothetical railroad through the precisely same interchange point in the exact same fashion, consistent with how the railroads move the traffic in the real world.
Right, and it's, as I understand its argument, their argument is that the statute actually compels that.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And as I understand their argument, and then I want to see if I can state it and see if we agree that this is their argument, okay? Their argument is that under 10703, it requires carriers to establish through routes, which include physical connections with each other, right? And then to establish a rate for those routes, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. And then their argument, the next step in their argument is, so when you get to 704A1, which is a question of rate reasonableness, okay, the rate the board is considering the reasonableness of is under 703, the rate for a through route that includes a physical connection. That's their argument, right?
I believe that's an argument they tried to make. That's correct, Your Honor.
Their argument's like, I didn't invent this. That's what their blue brief says.
That's correct.
So why don't you begin by telling me where in the board's decision it responds to that argument?
Absolutely, Your Honor. Okay. If you look on page 12 of the board's decision, at the top, it specifically takes on the incumbent railroad, they say, has a, quote, statutory right to select the point of interchange.
And that doesn't respond to their 703-704 argument.
Well, I believe it does.
The rate that is at issue in reasonableness inquiry is a rate for, is a through rate with an interchange point. I'm looking for where the board responded to that.
Well, if I could, Your Honor, the next three pages specifically address the underlying arguments, and the conclusion of that analysis about their statutory argument is on page 14, where then the board concludes, in the end, the reasonableness of joint rates, quote, charged and collected, their 10704 argument, right, in this case is properly being judged against the simulated competitive price of a single hypothetical SAR.
That's the conclusion. What's the answer to their argument that under the statute, the board, in developing the standalone rate, is not free to exclude to change the interchange rates because of 10703 and 10704?
I understand.
That's all I'm looking for.
No, I understand.
Okay, where is that?
I think, while not explicit, it's fairly implicit when the board specifically says that the congressional language, the only congressional language, specifically indicates that the rate standard for the reasonableness of joint rates shall be the same as for all rates.
Well, but again, their statutory arguments suggest that that's different with respect to through rates because of 703 and 704.
Understood.
Now, the board may have a good answer to that, but I didn't see it either explicitly or implicitly in the decision.
Understood. And I think the board's position would be that it's implicit in their discussion of their statutory argument, and particularly taking up their 10705 argument, noting that, as you note, they combine 10703 with both 10704 and 10705, and the board specifically addresses the 10705 argument, noting that nothing in the decision dictates how they have to actually, in the real world, set the interchange, that in the first instance is their right, but that what we're doing here is merely establishing what the reasonableness should be for the rate that's being charged for that movement.
Okay, well, setting aside what's in the board decision or in your brief, what just tell me now, what is your answer to their argument that 703 sets the standard for what a rate is in other words, what is your answer to their argument that when you're looking at the definition of the rate whose reasonableness is at stake, that you look to 703 and 704?
Well, I would say in your hypothetical earlier where we were talking about it, when you went from 10703 to 10704, I would argue that it goes off the rails. As the board,
so to speak.
Yes, Your Honor. As you note, 10701 establishes that a rate must be reasonable. And then in 10702, it specifically says, in making that reasonableness determination, here's the criteria that the board should use.
Now, right, but I don't mean to repeat myself, but he uses the word rate.
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay. And their theory is that the rate here is a rate under 703, and a through rate that includes a physical interchange point.
Right. And okay. I would respond that 10703 says nothing about the reasonableness of that rate.
Correct. They don't say it does. They say, though, when you're looking at a rate reasonableness question, i.e. rate, you've got to look at 703 and 703 to find out what it is. And then they say if you want to challenge the interchange, the interchange points, okay, you do that under 705A1. The board has authority under that to challenge the specific interchange rates, but outside of that, if you're doing a rate reasonableness analysis, you look to 703 to find out what the rate is you're asking about. Now, maybe there's a good answer to that, but that's their theory.
I understand their theory, and I would say that given the legislative history, and you combine that with decades of board precedent on rate reasonableness, which has been affirmed by this court, if you take the railroad's argument to its logical conclusion, which the rate reasonableness test must be run on the rate charged or collected, then their argument would be applicable not just in the context of 10703, it would be applicable in the context of 10704, and equally applicable to single line rates as well, which then would take the board's entire SAC analysis and make it for all and
why would it be applicable to a single line rate?
Well, as they say in their opening brief at page 20, the rate charged to point A is different than the rate charged to point B. So what they're saying is If the SAR reroutes the traffic, if the SAR builds different facilities than the existing railroad, it's not the exact same rate that's being quote charged or collected on 10704. Joint rates are unitary rates. The entities are to be treated as a single legal entity.
Right, they accept all that. That's not inconsistent with their argument.
But if you look at their argument on the legislative history, their argument is all the legislative history tells us is that joint rates need to be treated the same as all other rates for purpose of the rate reasonableness, which means just apply SAC, but don't apply it in a way that we don't like. And we don't believe that the statutory language 10703, that their interpretation is appropriate given the unitary nature of joint rates, given our SAC rules, and given the legislative histories. Remember, we don't believe this is a Chevron 1 case. We don't believe that the statute speaks directly to the issue.
It doesn't have to be for their theory. Their theory
Correct.
Is that even if it's Chevron 2, it required a board response to explain why the rate whose reasonableness is being questioned did not have to consider or include the physical interchange.
I would agree, but I would argue there's two parts to that. The first is that the board's interpretation under Chevron 2 need not be the one the court prefers or the one that defendants.
Exactly.
Just need to
but
be a preferable.
But their point is we don't have a board interpretation.
Well, that would be their court. We would beg to disagree. We would believe that implicit.
But you agree
with
me that there's nothing in the board decision that directly responds to this.
I would not agree with that, Your Honor. I would believe that page 12, the language that says we specific. Pardon me? I'm sorry, Your Honor.
We were at least back to implicit.
That I believe, yes, okay.
Okay, so
but I believe that
here.
We take up explicitly the statutory argument.
Okay. Okay, go ahead.
The petitioner, the EPCO for its part, wants to ask for more rate relief. They concede as part of this that there's actually three railroads who participate. There's BNSF, there's UP, and then there's the Southwest Railroad. The board in its decision agreed specifically with the railroads that you had to reflect the real-world costs of the participating railroads in the 180% variable cost calculation, and that the board had just recently addressed this in the Kansas City Power and Light case. I think it's instructive to note in the opening of the Kansas City Power and Light case on page 1, that when you're doing the 180% revenue to variable cost calculation, this is the exact same calculation that's done under 10707. In other words, in that case, UP had stipulated to it. In this case, we found that we were setting the rate prescription at the statutory floor for regulatory rate relief, because that's where the board's jurisdiction ends. That's where, under the market dominance determination of 10707, we set the 180% level, and we're instructed under 10707 to use IRCS. And IRCS obviously is the board's uniform rail costing system. And this is what the Kansas City Power decision clearly talks about. To deviate from that, notwithstanding that the Southwest Railroad in this case may have been a cost savings or may have provided other benefits to BNSF, once we start deviating from the uniform rail cost system in one case, as this court is well aware from having addressed the no movement specific adjustment bar on a number of occasions, we open up a huge Pandora's box, because then we start looking at BNSF's costs and we start looking at UP's costs, and then it runs afoul of our attempt in major issues to balance the competing interests, the time, the complexity, and the expense that's required to streamline those calculations. With respect to the form of the rate, it's our position they've not been harmed. We understand that at some point in the future, there may be some impact, which we have said in the decision they can bring to us on a case-by-case basis at whatever time it is this arises. We found that because they're still going to be paying 180% of the variable costs going forward, regardless if it's a joint or a proportional rate, that we absolutely do not think that there was any inconsistency with the underlying analysis. And finally,
you agree that they will be harmed at some point in the future?
No, we do not.
Okay.
We believe it was entirely speculative. We believe they're going to have to reconcile the IRC's inputs for the two railroads, regardless of whether it's a joint or proportional rate. Now, there are hypotheticals, Your Honor, where perhaps that there might be a disagreement with the railroads about inputs of one type or another. Mm-hmm. And usually what happens is the parties reconcile those themselves in a commercially practical way, and if they can't, as in the Oklahoma gas case, they come back to us with a petition that says we need help resolving this dispute. Mm-hmm. But that's all future harm. That's all stuff that could happen in the future. And there was nothing concrete that they brought to us. And quite frankly, a lot of the stuff they put in their petition, including the addendum that they added to their reply brief, was never put before the board, and we don't think it's properly before this court for consideration. Again, BNSF acquisition premium, the board did a rulemaking on that. BNSF's going to have to restate its acquisition premium as part of the Berkshire Hathaway case. What that's going to cause is, retroactively, then you're going to have a restatement of variable costs, which will impact the revenues from the joint rate. UP wanted to be disentangled from that whole rigmarole and not have to waste time trying to figure out how to recalculate its revenue portion, and the board thought that was reasonable. So unless the court has further questions, we ask that the court deny the petition.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Did counsel have any time left? Okay, you can each take 1 minute.
Thank you, Ed. Judge Hale, I think you had it exactly right. There was no answer from the board to our statutory argument. We don't think there was an answer that the board could have provided that was different than the one that we urged the board to accept. But if there was one, we don't know what it is. There's nothing for this court to defer to. The answers that they provided really don't address the statute, as you noted, saying that they've got history and precedent behind their standalone cost test doesn't matter because they've never faced, they've never addressed the application of that precedent to 10703. And all we're saying is apply your standalone cost principles within the confines of the statute. Their arguments about joint and several rates also are besides the point. They don't address how you test the rate. They address the railroad's responsibility once that, whether the rate is reasonable, has been determined. So I agree, the board has not answered those points.
Okay, thank you.
With respect to the statutory construction issue, the Congress said in the Congress report and the board said that the rate standard, the rate reasonableness of joint rates shall be the same as for all rates. This is a joint through rate. It's a joint rate. The rate standard should be the same. With respect to IRCs, APCO's approach uses system average IRCs. It just applies it in a way that makes sense. APCO, to the extent it conceded that the short line is a part of the movement, it's a part of the movement because it works as BNSS subcontractor. The short line has no direct relationship with APCO. And with respect to the harm from the switch to the proportional rates, APCO, you know, it's not speculative. APCO has already been harmed once at this point. And with respect to what we raised below in our petition before the board, we addressed the matter at page 11, and the board in its decision never cited that portion of our filing. Thank you very much.
Thank you, gentlemen. Case is submitted.